Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of a recent episode exploring the history of investors holding businesses accountable and the dawn of the ESG, or Environmental Social Governance, movement.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The world is fighting a pathogen-caused global pandemic right now, but it's also fighting another contagion, an economic one, driven by fear, uncertainty, and perhaps the revelation of unsettling fragilities in the global economy. Markets everywhere have dropped, so we want to take a step back and try to understand why this has all happened so quickly. And once we know that, we can ask, are Washington and other national governments taking the right steps to help the global economy achieve a healthy recovery? How long might that take? And what should we as individuals do in the interim? So this hour on Point, coronavirus and the global economy. Now, I couldn't think of anyone better to help us sort through these questions than Rana Faruhar. She joins us from New York. She's global business columnist and associate editor at the Financial Times. She's also CNN's global economic analyst. Rana, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you so much. Nice to be here.
First of all, how are you doing?
I'm good. I'm maniacally hand washing. I have this whole corona protocol set up in my house. I have a sign on the door. Anyone who enters the home has to go immediately to the powder room and wash hands for 20 seconds and then disinfect doorknobs and light switches. So, I've become one of those people that runs downstairs to make sure that, you know, folks are in the powder room. But nobody's sick yet. So.
Okay. Good. Well, we need those people right now, right? Collectively, we all need to be that person.
Tell that to my children, who, by the way, are being homeschooled. Like, you know, teachers everywhere need a raise immediately. That's what I say.
No, you don't know how hard it is until you got to do it yourself, for sure.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay. So, Rana, is the entire global economy right now headed in one direction? Because that direction does not feel very good.
Yeah, we're headed to a global recession. I think that there's very little doubt, really, at this stage that that's going to happen. You know, Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, came out the other day and said, look, we're probably going to see 20% unemployment. And immediately people were like, oh my gosh, that's impossible. That's unprecedented. Well, just today, jobless claims spiked to an all-time high. I think we could be headed there. This is about as serious a shock, certainly, as we've seen since 2008. But, you know, and we can explore this more, but in some ways, what's happening is actually closer to a 1929 type situation for a lot of reasons.
Okay, so tell us why then.
Well, it's interesting. If you overlay a graph of where the markets have been in the last few years, they've been climbing up, 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 up. And, you know, I've discussed that with you in the past. Mm-hmm. And they're now starting to go down, 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 down. And if you overlay a graph of the last, say, 10 years with the period from 1918, which is right around the time of the Spanish flu, until 1932, you'd be surprised how similar those two graphs are. And there are a lot of factors in play here. So we can start with the coronavirus, which is just a huge demand shock, right? I mean, demand and supply, actually. I mean, for starters, just take the American economy. I mean, we are three-fourths consumer spending, give or take, and nobody's able to go outside and spend. I mean, I live in Park Slope, Brooklyn. I just walked out this morning. Literally every shop, every restaurant, every bar on my block is closed. People can still shop online, but that spending, first of all, is going to go to a handful of companies and is also not going to replace what has been shut down abruptly in the real world. Mm-hmm. So that's point number one. And that's happening everywhere. I mean, in some cases, what's happening in Europe is even more extreme and draconian right now than what's happening in the US. We're probably going to see an economic contraction in the next couple of quarters that is actually more extreme than what we saw during the great financial crisis. But this is also coming at a time when the markets have been headed up for many, many years, but they've, just as in the period leading up to the market crash of 1929, they have been propped up by a lot of what I would call financial engineering. I mean, this is something I wrote a book about. My book, Makers and Takers, is sort of all about how we got to the point that I think we're at now, where you've had big American companies pumping up their stock prices by doing share buybacks, which sort of artificially inflates the price but doesn't actually change what's happening on the ground in companies. We've had four decades of globalization driving down wages, outsourcing of capital, jobs, taxes, tax money, I should say, into offshore tax havens. All of this has contributed to share prices that have gone way, way up, but it's actually degraded the real economy. And what's happening now, and coronavirus in some ways is just the trigger for this. It could have been a number of things. What's happening now is that asset bubble is bursting. And what's so interesting is I think we are only just at the beginning of understanding how dependent the American economy in particular has become on asset prices constantly going up. I mean, we've run our economy for 40 years on the idea of asset prices going up, housing prices going up. And when they don't go up, we don't grow. And that's going to be a big deal.
So, okay. So this is so fascinating, Rana. Let's dig into it a little bit more because I hear you when you say, 40 years of financial engineering, essentially, not matching economic output, which, in and of itself is such a disturbing thing to think about, right? Because
100%.
Because we have been habituated into looking at, into thinking that the markets are representative somewhat of what economic output should be, but there's obviously a decoupling there. But then you also say, you flip that though and also say, but yet the American economy has become dependent on those very asset prices. How does that work?
Well, it's very, I don't know which metaphor you use, chicken and egg or the tail wagging the dog. I mean, what's so interesting is just if I can go back and talk a little bit of history here. If you think about where the economy was before these changes really started, so I'd pin that around the 1970s. At that point, the financial system, the markets were just a facilitator for the real economy. So banks lent money mainly to homeowners and businesses. Though the businesses grew, they employed people. Individuals got mortgages. They bought a home. They made most of their money from income. But over the course of 40 years, the system changed. And now the majority of what banks do is actually not lending. It's mostly trading, which helps to prop up share prices. You had a variety of changes, small changes throughout different areas of policy, the tax code, corporate governance, the way in which companies can buy back their own shares, for example. And this is an important thing right now because buybacks are they're kind of a wonky concept, but they're quite important because you remember the Trump tax cuts of 2017. Well, most of that money, which, of course, the president falsely told us, oh, that's all going to go back onto Main Street. It's going to be great. Companies are going to employ lots of people. The vast majority of that money went into corporations buying back their own shares that artificially pushes up share prices because it sort of takes supply off the market. But the majority of shares, 80% of all stocks, are owned by 12% of the population. So that's enriching a very, very small part of the population. Meanwhile, average real weekly wages are pretty much where they have been since the 1970s. So those of us who make most of our money from paychecks are really, we haven't seen a real wage gain in some time. The people that own assets have gotten very, very rich. And so the economy is now so dependent on that bubble. And to be fair, we're all, those of us who have 401ks, and that's, a little over half the population, we're kind of all in this in a bit of a Faustian bargain. You know, I mean, we look at the, I'm trying not to look at my 401k, but although I actually sold out to cash in the summer.
I was just going
to
say, Arana,
you know, so I don't want to be smug at the moment, but you look at that and you get worried at a time like this. I mean, this is why there's so much free-floating anxiety right now. People are looking at their retirement and they're seeing it just go,
right.
You know? And
so, Rana, can I just jump in here, though? Because there's this one thing that you pointed to that I really want to underscore. I mean, when you build a nation's economic well-being on essentially an asset bubble, bubble, the problem is... One of the many problems is when that bubble bursts, it harms everyone, right? Because we're seeing economic slowdown, or we're projecting an economic slowdown across like every imaginable sector right now. I'm not seeing one sector that's saying, or maybe if you're making masks at the moment, I don't know.
Amazon is the one company.
Yeah. But do you see what I'm saying? It harms everybody.
That's right. And, you know, it's about choices as a nation. You know, I think that we've been making the wrong choices and we've been bolstering the wrong things for some time. And now the chickens are coming home to roost.
Are we alone in this, though? Because we're seeing the markets tank everywhere. I mean, we can't be the only country that's done this.
No, we're not. Although, you know, it's interesting. I think a number of other countries that have stronger underlying economies, yes, they're all being hit by coronavirus right now, but I think that a number of other countries are going to recover faster and better, whereas I think that these kind of fundamental problems in the American economy that we're talking about here are going to actually prevent a quick recovery. And one thing I would point to, it's interesting that in recent days, many, many nations have announced major fiscal stimulus programs, right? There's going to be bailouts. There's going to be individual cash payments to people. In Europe in particular, we're seeing a bolstering of the social safety net, which was already stronger than it was in America. Lots of spending. We can parse that. But here's the interesting thing. Stock markets in Asia and Europe are actually starting to pick up faster than in the U.S. And to me, that says investors are worried about the U.S. economy fundamentally in a way that they are not worried about the rest of the world.
But we are talking about the global economy and, of course, also the United States economy in the midst of a global pandemic. I'm joined by Rana Faruhar. She's the global business columnist and associate editor at the Financial Times. We want to know what your questions are about the state of the global economy and the best next steps for the United States to take to achieve a healthy recovery as and when that hopefully will come. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the balanced scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big, whoa, kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are trying to understand the state of the global economy right now, and of course, the state of the U.S. economy, as well as the entire world grapples with coronavirus. I'm joined today by Rana Faruhar. She is Financial Times Global Business and Global Business columnist and associate editor. And if you've got extra time now, if you have to spend more time at home, Rana's also written a couple of great books, Makers and Takers being one of them, about the financialization of the U.S. economy. And her most recent book is called Don't Be Evil, about Silicon Valley. But Rana, let me play here a moment from European Central Bank President Christine Lagarde. She unveiled a plan last Thursday to help European economies and to prop up financial institutions to keep lending in the midst of this crisis. So here's Lagarde.
Governments and all other policy institutions are called upon to take timely and targeted actions to address the public health challenge of containing the spread of the coronavirus and mitigate the economic impact.
So that's ECB President Christine Lagarde. And she, Rana, she also called for collective action here. So I'm wondering, how different is where we are in 2020 versus where we were in 2008, where we did actually see a lot of central banks working together to contain the fallout from the financial crisis?
Well, it's interesting. There's a lot in there. I mean, Europe, let me just speak about Europe particularly for a moment. Europe's in an interesting situation because in some ways, the problems in Europe always have to do with political union. Is the European Union going to come together politically and kind of be a United States of Europe? Or are they going to try and be individual states and, you know, pool resources in good times, but not really look after each other in bad? And Lagarde is one of the many, you know, pro-EU folks that are saying, okay, got to pull together right now. But then there's this larger question of how global authorities work together and how folks work together transatlantically. Now, as you point out, in 2008, 2009, central bankers globally came together, and central bankers have an easier time talking to one another than politicians do because they're not elected. You know, they don't have to deal with local political concerns. They're essentially very clever technocrats that can come together and think about things just in terms of policy and say, what would be good for the global economy right now? Well, in 2008, 2009, they decided what would be good is to lower rates and pour a lot of money into the markets, which they did. I mean, globally, central bankers poured over $30 trillion into the markets over the last decade. The Fed alone put in over $4 trillion. And that had the effect, to go back to our earlier conversation, that had the effect of propping up markets.
Right.
I mean, what this monetary policy, which is what central bankers offer, what that does is it pushes people into things like stocks and riskier assets, and then it makes that asset bubble go up. Now, that doesn't create growth, though, at the ground level. I mean, that's the sort of thing that takes actual businesses, you know, and often small businesses, family-owned businesses that are investing real seed corn into local communities, really innovating. There's a lot of research to show that really smaller companies and private companies tend to do that better than companies once they go public and get bigger. But the upshot now is that these central bankers are kind of out of ammunition, right? They've already lowered rates to rock. I mean, they're at zero and they're negative in many countries. We actually have negative rates now on 30-year treasury bills in the U.S., which is unprecedented. That means that people are paying for other people to borrow their money. I mean, it's a strange inverted world.
Yeah. The upside down for real.
It's the upside down for real. But what that tells you is, and this is actually quite a profound point, the fact that so many people around the world are willing to actually lend money and have it cost them means they're worried about losing money in bigger ways in other kinds of assets. So that's a bad situation.
Okay, So on that point, this is what I'm wondering. What we saw after the monetary policy that went into effect in 2008 is we saw that bull market, right?
Which
people were like barely hanging on to. We've been riding that until now, essentially. That's over. So it sounds like what you're saying is that may not happen again this time around.
I don't think it will. I don't think it will. You know, there's a lot of discussion out there right now, and I want to be fair and say there is some disagreement about how this is going to go. But, you know, economists often talk about different shapes of recovery, a market recovery and also a real economic recovery. They talk about a V recovery where, you know, okay, maybe the markets go down very quickly, but then they come up quickly. There's a U recovery where it kind of, they go down really sharply and then it takes a while for them to come back up. There's W's, up and down, up and down. And then there's an L, which is really what you don't want. They go down and then they kind of flatline. I'm worried about that. I'm worried. I definitely don't think we're in a V. I personally don't think we're in a U. I think we're a W potentially headed to an L when it comes to at least U.S. stock prices. And this is going to happen over time. I mean, this may take years to sort of play out. But when I look out in the global economy right now and I think about all the things that have boosted the price of big U.S. companies in the last 40 years. Globalization, well, that's changing. You know, the U.S. and China are decoupling. I think coronavirus and all the fragilities that it has exposed in supply chains are actually going to make the world much more regional and local for reasons that are both good and bad. So that's point number one. Demographically, the U.S. is aging. Most of the developed world is aging. Growth is basically people plus productivity. So where's the growth in population? Well, it's in emerging markets typically. Technological change is going to take more jobs. I personally think a lot of the jobs that are being lost right now in the coronavirus may not come back. I think companies are going to try and replace people with software. That's going to become a political problem. So all of these factors and all the debt and you know, kind of financial engineering that I mentioned have buoyed stock prices. I don't think we're going to reset to that period again. And so, yeah, I'm worried. And I'll tell you, Meghna, one thing I'm really thinking a lot about, because I actually get a lot of personal emails about this. People say to me, you know, they kind of have an instinctual feeling. I don't feel good about this. I'm not sure about this put your money in an index fund and forget about it advice. That's what we've all been told for 40 years. I mean, I just turned 50 last week, and basically my entire life, I can remember my mother, that when I came out of college, put your money in an index fund, you know, and then don't look at it. Yeah, that was good advice for all of us. I don't know if that's going to be good advice going forward, and I don't say that lightly.
Okay, so in a couple of minutes, we're going to bring in Michelle Singletary, who's amazing, to talk specifically about this. But before we do that, Rana, okay, I'm going to take a deep breath here because
Sorry. I'm like panicking. I feel like I need to, you know, offer some sort of intellectual Valium, but I don't know.
Well, what we want is factual, sober analysis for sure. So I'm not saying like change what you think, but I'm just going to take a deep breath here.
Okay.
Refocus for a moment because I want to talk about sort of the immediate reactions that we've seen, for example, just in the past week or two from Washington to deal with the current like emergency that we're all experiencing. So first of all, here is Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin speaking on Tuesday at a White House press conference.
We're looking at sending checks to Americans immediately. And what we've heard from hardworking Americans, many companies have now shut down, whether it's bars or restaurants. Americans need cash now, and the president wants to get cash now. And I mean now in the next 2 weeks.
So that's Steven Mnuchin on Tuesday. Now, over at the Fed, they have acted decisively in this moment. The central bank announced that it was cutting interest rates to near zero, a level not seen since 2008. Here's Fed Chairman Jerome Powell, talking about that decision during a conference call with reporters on Sunday.
The actions we have announced today will help American families and businesses, and indeed our entire economy, weather this difficult period, and will foster a more vigorous return to normal once the disruptions from the coronavirus abate.
That's Jerome Powell on Sunday. So, Rana, just briefly, how would you assess the federal government's first attempts at responding to the coronavirus?
Well, you know, I think to the extent that we're starting to get some real fiscal policy, that's a good thing. You know, a lot of people have been asking me, what do I think about the idea of sending everybody a $1,000 check or a series of them? You know, in an ideal world, you would means test. I'm very lucky. I have a full-time benefit of job. I don't need an extra $1,000 right now. My cleaning lady, who cannot work from home, does. But we don't have time for that right now. So you can do this sort of money dump and then recapture this money from people who really didn't need it later on in the tax code. I'm okay with that. What I would really like to see, though, and I think this should be a big push in the next phases of fiscal policy, and we're going to see several of them, we need to help small businesses. You know, I mean, I'm very worried that we're kind of in this 2008-2009 paradigm where you've suddenly got this long queue of businesses that want bailouts. You know, the airline business, for example, is asking for $60 billion, or actually, I think it's more than that now at this point. I'm not even sure what it is, but it's a lot. Actually, Boeing is asking for $60. The airline industry as a whole is asking for $200. Well, all right, this is an industry that made a lot of money in the last few years, and guess what it spent 96% of its spare cash on? Share buy. Buybacks. So yeah. I don't want to be in that kind of situation where we have as a nation a sense that big businesses are getting the majority of the pie with no strings attached and individuals and small businesses are being left hung out to dry. Not only is that bad economically, it would be very destructive politically.
I'm thinking that it's a moral imperative now.
100%. Absolutely. 100%. We cannot be back in that situation that we were in post-great financial crisis where individuals are just like, you know, I have just been completely hosed to bail out banks. I've lost my home. I mean, that's how we got the politics that we have at the moment.
Well, so speaking of individuals, I am really delighted now to bring into the conversation Michelle Singletary. She's joining us via Skype from Bowie, Maryland. She's the personal finance columnist for The Washington Post, and her column, The Color of Money, is syndicated in newspapers across the country. Michelle, welcome back to On Point.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Okay, so for all those individuals out there whose heads are spinning right now trying to figure out what to do, I mean, what are the kind of questions you're getting, Michelle, from people, and what are you telling them?
Well, obviously, everybody's worried about the stock market. Many people, the way they're invested is through their retirement accounts, and they're seeing it go down almost daily. They're wondering if they're laid off, what should they pay first? Are they going to be evicted? I mean, there's panic, almost more so than the virus itself. People are saying, I'm not worried about getting sick. I'm worried about the fact that I'm not going to be able to make my mortgage payment next month or make my credit card payments. And so people are just scared to death right now.
Yeah. And so what are you telling them on how to manage those like pressing immediate concerns?
Yeah. I mean, my heart is so heavy because what can you tell them? So what I say is right now, instead of hoarding toilet paper, hoard cash. And so you just have to pay the essentials right now. You know, concentrate on the things you absolutely need. And even food, for example, people are so panicked. Only buy what you need for, you know, maybe a weekly or two or biweekly basis, because you don't know what's going to happen. Now, the good thing is because we're all in it together. It's unlikely people are going to be evicted in the next month or two. First of all, the courts are closed. So how are they even going to go to court to put you out? And utility companies saying they're not going to cut off people's electricity. Thank goodness for most of the country, we're coming out of winter, so there's no, you know, a lot of issues about heating. And so I'm just telling people, like, for example, if you've been aggressively paying off your credit card debt, pull back on that. Just make the minimum payments. The thing right now that is of value is cash. So that you can pay for the things that you need. Now if lots of people are home, but if you're home, just comb your budget for anything that you can cut so that you can have it. Because here's the thing, we're okay for probably about a month or two. It's when we get into the summer, if this goes on, the financial companies, I think, are going to be gracious to people. It's when it stretches out, which is what happened with 2008, 2009. Initially, everybody's like, yeah, we got you. And then they didn't have us.
Yeah. Well, let me just go to a caller quickly here, if I can. Let's go to Jim, who's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a post-tax retirement account, and I'm wondering if it would be a good idea to move that into cash to prevent further losses. Thanks.
Thanks for that question, Jim. Michelle, what do you think?
Lord.
You know, and I'll take a stand on that one if you want.
Yeah, here's the thing. Yes and no. If you need money immediately, you have to do what you have to do. You have to cash out to put money to pay your bills. I wouldn't move all of it right now because we don't know what the market's going to do. There may be a bounce enough that you'll get back something, and then you can reallocate your assets. And this is a difficult question to ask because everybody's asking, what should I do now? And none of us know what's going to happen in the next 6 months to a year. I do know that once you sell, you lock in your losses. And for some people, they're like, I don't care. I can't take this anymore. And if that's you, that may be what you have to do.
Yeah.
I'm not doing that. I'm not panicking right now. But can I just add this real quick? And I know, Rhonda, you want to get in. This is why it's always good. When we talk about our financial resources, we mostly focus on retirement and investing. But if you don't have debt right now, if you have paid off your mortgage, you can weather this a little bit better. And to Rhonda's point about this sort of financial engineering, there was a whole, you know, discussion about, oh, don't pay off your mortgage, put the money in the market.
Right.
And I, you know, was beating that drum for years, how you cannot listen to the money changers when they tell you that, because that's to their advantage. And now I don't look so crazy right now when I told people don't take a mortgage into retirement, pay it off as quickly as you can, because the less debt you have to service, you can weather this a little bit better.
Right. Well, Rhonda, what do you think?
I'm so with you. I have to say, I'm like, you know, grew up in rural Indiana. I'm allergic to debt. I'm just like a good Midwestern girl with this stuff. To answer the caller, I mean, as you know, Meghna, I actually sold up everything. My children's 529s last January, February, and then I sold my own retirement into cash and cash equivalents last August because I thought that the crash was going to come then. I had no doubt there was a crash coming. You know, a lot of people gave me a hard time because I missed that run up between August and January, but I'm okay with that because I wanted to feel secure. I wouldn't sell right now. Just, I know we've got the music here. Look for that W, wait for an uptick. We'll get another one, but then I think we will get a correction. At that point, talk to your advisor, think about reallocation.
Yeah. So doing it in the midst of a crisis is not really what's being advised at all right now. But Michelle and Rhonda, stand by here for just a second. We've got a lot more questions for both of you when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about coronavirus and the global economy, and yes, also the U.S. economy as well, and how it's having an impact on us all. Rana Faruhar joins us today. She's Financial Times global business columnist and associate editor, and she's also a global economic analyst for CNN. Michelle Singletary is also with us. She's personal finance columnist for The Washington Post, and her column, The Color of Money, is nationally syndicated as well. Michelle, I had a couple specific questions for you to get your view on some of the things that Rana was saying to us earlier in the hour. First of all, what would be your assessment on how Washington and how the government has reacted so far to help Americans through this first immediate period of this economic slowdown?
I'm in my feelings right now, so let me just say what's in my feelings. A little too little too late is what my feelings are saying right now. And even as they're discussing those payments that are going to send people, when you look at the details, they're still zeroing out some of the most vulnerable people in the population.
That's right.
So the people who are going to get the checks really aren't the people who absolutely need them. Every dollar is precious to me. So I would never say, oh, $600 or $1,000 is not a lot of money. But how far will that last? When people are paying 40 or 50% of their income for housing, when they still have co-payments for health insurance or no health insurance. I'm a Christian, so I'm not going to say what I really want to say.
Go on, Michelle. Let it rip.
But you know, I'm so angry at how, you know, now they want to do this huge bailout when all along people have been saying we need to take care of everyone. We need to have a system where people aren't going to go broke when they need health care. We need a system where have a living wage, where there's like, we look at the, you know, the minimum wage it's been depressed forever. And so now this virus is exposing how unhealthy our financial lives have been. And it's just, it pains me because those of us who are called to give people advice, what can we say?
Exactly.
There is no money. And it makes me, I don't know what to tell you when you lost your job and now you have your job is connected to your health care. If I could give everybody enough money to live, I would. I would clean out all of my accounts. I would be okay too because I've practiced all these things. But all along, when I've been saying, don't listen to these folks, pay off your debt, try to have an emergency fund. No, look to, I think what Rhonda was saying is the market isn't everything. And that was the answer to telling everybody everything. Whenever I tell people to pay off their mortgage, you would not believe the number of emails I would get from people. Don't tell people that. That's stupid. They should put it in the market because they'll get more.
I was just going to jump in. I mean, it's so interesting, Michelle, because the truth is that the government has actually been incentivizing us and companies to take on debt. I mean, frankly, the idea that we've been able until quite recently to, you know, there's been some changes in the amount of mortgage debt you can write off your taxes, but it's still an enormous amount. That is a subsidy to the financial system. Mm-hmm. That is not helping us to become more financially secure.
You know, I want to tell you. In fact, can I just jump in here this time? I'm sorry, ladies, but I just want to like affirm what both of you are saying. Because Michelle, especially in your just admission that you feel angry, you are the voice of millions of Americans right now.
Yeah,
there is
yeah.
no doubt. That is why I keep coming back to this. I think this is a moral reckoning that we're going through right now. So the question is, how do we rise to the moral demands of this moment? So Rana, let me ask you. I mean, this is a moment, if the political will is there, to go big, right? But what does go 100%. Big mean? What does that mean?
I will tell you, I've been thinking a lot about this. I would like to call on Joe Biden, all right? Joe Biden, this is a moment for you to come out clearly and say exactly what Michelle just said. This coronavirus has exposed the fundamental fragility of our go-it-alone economy. You know, I mean, we leave people in this country increasingly alone to deal with all the things that make you middle class: healthcare, education, and mortgages. And those are the only things that we have seen inflation, wild inflation in. In the last 40 years, our incomes haven't gone up. The price of our TVs has gone down because of outsourcing and financialization. But the things that we really need are out of reach for so many people. So we're going to fix that. If I were him, I would say, after I'm elected, fingers crossed, I'm just going to come out with my own political views there. After I'm elected, I am going to fix that. And I'll tell you, this is good political advice too, because there are a lot of young people that are despondent about this, that were Bernie supporters for exactly this reason, for, you know, because he's saying, look, I'm going to help you to actually get the things that will make you middle class. I'm going to fix the healthcare system. I'm going to fix student debt. Help bring those people under the tent now. Get them out to vote. Show us what that vision of this new, healthier, more balanced economy is going to look like.
Okay. So your political heart there revealed, but why couldn't you?
I mean, I'm a columnist. So I'm allowed to.
why couldn't you? Okay, what would you say right now to President Trump?
Say,
he's in that. What would you say
I
to House
say,
Speaker Pelosi or
I'd
or
say largely
Mitch McConnell?
The same thing. I would say we've got to get in. Here's the priorities. We have to, in terms of who gets to be front of line, individuals, companies that are getting federal aid must protect workers. They can't lay them off. They have to give them sick leave. They have to give them health care. Small businesses are next in line. That's the largest percent, the greatest chunk of American employment. They should receive not loans because they don't need more debt. Give them grants. Okay. They're creating the majority of American employment. That is not going to be a net negative for the economy going forward. Big companies, if they get bailed out, there are major strings attached. They cannot lay workers off. They cannot break union contracts. Perhaps the government should actually take an equity stake, so we would be privatizing socializing a few gains instead of, you know, privatizing gains and socializing losses.
Okay, so I'm seeing here a whole different set of ideas for a fiscal stimulus here, but you've also written about then following it up with like an infrastructure program.
100%. I mean, it's, you know, what's so interesting, and this is actually the good news here. All this stuff is connected. I mean, right now, what I would love to see is all the workers that are being laid off, let's get public resources into retraining them and, you know, perhaps helping incorporate them into healthcare efforts right now. Let's look at putting military resources and personnel to use in helping to build out hospitals. That would create some jobs in construction. I mean, there's so many ways in which all of this stuff is connected. Let's get the real economy working. Let's get Main Street working for a change and forget about Wall Street for the moment.
Right. So, Michelle.
And I think one of the things we could do is, in terms of retraining, is address the sort of education thing that's going on, that you should be able to go to school and get the training you need to get a decent job. And so let's pump some money into, for example, the community college system so that people can go and take classes. And also for consumers, those of us who always wanted things. Now, I'm a very frugal person, but that frugality came at a price, with jobs being going offshore. So maybe we don't get a shirt for $2. Maybe it's okay that we get a shirt for $5 if it's manufactured here. And if it's $5, because the reason why we want a $2 or $1 shirt is because we don't have enough money. So if you pay people a fair education, then they don't mind paying $5 for that shirt, because that job is also that $5 shirt is being made by someone here in the United States who's going to then help pay for their kids and pay for a roof over their head. And so
that's what Germany does. You know, I mean, other countries have made these choices. We can make these choices too.
Right. But we all have to realize that that may mean that you're not going to be a millionaire. Maybe you don't have a house with so many rooms that you don't want nobody to live in there but yourself. You know, maybe it goes back to this concept that not everybody has to live by themselves, that we have shared housing. Our values have to shift, because we all can't be at the top. It just doesn't work that way. But we do need to make sure that not so many people are at the bottom.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? Honestly, I could listen to the two of you for hours on end. I think you should do a podcast together. I just came up with that idea.
I kind of do, too. I'm sort of loving the whole, like, you know, macro, micro, like, bring it together kind of thing.
I would be 100% behind that. And I cannot thank both of you enough for spending this time with us today. We're going to have you back if we can, as we all continue to sort of try to navigate our way through this. So Michelle Singletary, personal finance columnist for The Washington Post and author of The Color of Money column, nationally syndicated, with us from Bowie, Maryland. Michelle, thank you so much.
You're so welcome. And if I could just tell people, I hope that they read all that we're writing, the posts we're writing as much as we can on how to help you right now before all these policies hopefully come into place.
Yeah. And so you say that you're writing right now. So we're going to put links to that at onpointradio.org so people can definitely know where to find it. And Rana Faruhar, global business columnist and associate editor for The Financial Times and CNN global economic analyst. Rana, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, we want to wrap up this week turning back to the sage of On Point. That's Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst, with us as always from Hanover, New Hampshire. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Meghna.
Okay. So how has this week been for you? And where's your mind and heart right now?
Meghna, I'm thinking about leadership in wartime. This week, the president said he's a wartime president now. We're in a war crisis. We're engaged against this invisible enemy, the virus, and there are models of leadership in wartime. One of them is the one we're seeing now. The Maryland Governor Hogan says there's just not enough of everything. Governor Cuomo in New York, as we heard, New York has 3,000 ventilators. It needs 30,000. Where will they come? The president said he perhaps could invoke the Defense Production Act to build them. We'll have to see. But is this the way you act in wartime? Well, here's another way you act in wartime. In May 1942, the Navy broke the Japanese code and learned that the Japanese were sending a fleet to Midway Island, hoping to lure out the American carriers and pulverize them with their battleships. With days to go, the USS Yorktown, which had been mauled fighting in the Coral Sea, limped into Pearl Harbor, trailing oil behind it. Admiral Nimitz, the Pacific Fleet commander, slapped on his hip boots, went down and looked at the keel and all the holes in the side of the ship. The engineer said, "Admiral, it's going to take weeks." He says, "You've got 3 days. 3 days." That's how you act in wartime. What happened? Hundreds, if not thousands, of workers descended on the Yorktown, working around the clock. 3 days later, the band incongruously playing California, Here I Come, the Yorktown sailed out of Pearl Harbor. It was on station at the Battle of Midway. Dauntless dive bombers from the Yorktown sunk 3 Japanese carriers on that day, the most decisive battle for the United States in World War II. The carrier wouldn't have been there but for the way Admiral Nimitz acted with urgency, with no delay. Mm-hmm. And it is quite a contrast with the way the federal government, at least, has been acting throughout.
So I hear you, Jack, in terms of the urgency of a mobilization, right, of the best of America on this public health crisis rather than a political war here. But I wonder, okay, so are there examples, though, of perhaps leaders whose character didn't initially suit the moment that they found themselves in, but they ended up rising to it? They transformed themselves to meet the needs of the nation at the time.
Well, John F. Kennedy in the Cuban Missile Crisis, I mean, he ran in 1960 as a hawk on the missile gap with the Soviet Union. There was no missile gap. At Vienna, he had in 1961, he had harsh words with Khrushchev. And it looked like there was going to be, and he was known as the coldest of cold warriors, stand up to the Russians. What happened in the Cuban Missile Crisis? He refused to bomb or to even consider bombing the Cuban, the missiles in Cuba. And now we know those missiles were armed. They were nuclear armed. He would not do it. And he would even accept a defeat if necessary, that is, leaving the missiles rather than bomb them. In fact, we know from the Kennedy tapes, he was willing to even accept a limited nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union without retaliating massively. And he set up a face-saving gesture with Khrushchev, whereby we gave up our missiles in Turkey, which are obsolete anyway, and he gave up the missiles in Cuba, and they settled the crisis without blowing up the world. That was a John F. Kennedy transcending his campaign rhetoric, transcending himself, and showing the kind of profile and courage that he saw in other American leaders through history, but not by being tough, but by being wise.
Oh, yeah. You know, I've said this word three times during this hour, at least twice. Here's the third one, that I think there is a moral reckoning that we may all be experiencing right now. And the question is, can the moral imperative pierce the politics that grip the United States now? And I very much hope that it can. I mean, fundamentally, I'm still an optimist about this country. So that's where I'm going to put my hopes for, that we can use the moral, what's the word I'm looking for? The moral imperative of this moment for the bettering of us all. So I'm just going to leave you with that thought, Jack.
Amen. The fierce urgency of now, you might say.
See, this is why we have you, Jack, because you give voice to the things that we're all thinking. So Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Meghna.
And by the way, folks, our coronavirus coverage continues on Monday. We're going to be talking about loneliness in a time of physical distancing. If you've got a comment or a question about that, give us a call at 617-353-0683. And behalf of on my entire spectacular staff, both here and working from home, I want to say that On Point cares about you so much, our family of listeners. So send me a tweet at MeghnaWBUR. Let me know how you're doing, okay? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big, whoa, kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.